Accession number 14298, reel 3.
Mr. Bunce, reel 3.
Coastal batteries were far in, but were not in any way big enough to do any damage, I don't think. And certainly the vessels had passed the critical point where they might have been done some damage. The next line of defence was, of course, 825 Squadron. Admiral Ramsay had contacted Admiral of the Fleet, Dudley Pound, and said that he didn't want to send 825 Squadron into this at daylight. Pound had come back with the usual Nelson stuff about we will attack the enemy at all stages and at all times. And so Ramsay had nothing more to do but to leave it to Esmond to make up his mind whether to attack. Going back to the RAF for a moment, I think it was at Biggin Hill, they controlled all the fighter aircraft, and somebody on Ramsay's staff had said, right, you must give us plenty of cover for these swordfish to go in. And it was arranged that three squadrons would of Spitfires would cover us. And two squadrons of Hurricanes would go in and attack the escorting boats and whatnot. At Biggin Hill, it said that somebody said Fuller was in operation. They went to the safe to find out what Fuller was, and the intelligence officer was on leave with the key. So the squadrons took off from Biggin Hill with the vague thing that they had to escort some swordfish out over the channel. But they'd never done this before. Swordfish had carried on laying mines and attacking E-boats and the like. And they couldn't understand what it was. Nobody told them that there was half the German fleet out there. And it appears Esmond, very white in the face, had decided that we had to go. So we took off, circled over the coast for a bit, and saw some swordfish overhead. Some Spitfires overhead. And I assumed, and presumably he assumed, that the others were close by. But it turned out that it was only one squadron of Spitfires that were going to escort us. So as the ships were now moving away from us quite fast, Esmond's instructions was to go down onto the sea and belt hell for leather for to intercept the Germans. I was in the first flight again, flying in the same relative aircraft as I was on the Bismarck. Across from me was Ginger Johnson, also in the same relative aircraft on the Bismarck. The tag in Esmond's aircraft was a fellow called Clintz, as we called him. He had been in the squadron on the Bismarck attack, but his pilot had never gone into attack. only 8 of us that attacked with him. And he was flying with Esmond and observer called Williams. I remember putting the thumbs up sign, exchanging the thumbs up sign with Ginger Johnson, and we now knew what the RAF types had said in the mess when they said that there was a new German fighter called the Focke-Wulf 190. We were both preparing a Vickers GO-303s by getting them up off the mountain, and we began... I sat down then, and the first thing I remember was looking forward and seeing a destroyer. And then next thing I knew, Focke-Wulf 190s were on our tail. And when I said there was more than one, there was several of them. And they then seemed just to circle us constantly. No sooner was one at left than there was another one in place. And all that went through my mind at that time was the 303 obviously wasn't going to be a match to any cannon that they had. So the only thing I could do was to show that there was some resistance here, so I kept trying to put enough tracer in front of them to indicate that. They at one time they were putting down their wheels and flaps to try and slow down. The tracer was coming at us from all sides. I could actually see the pilots out of the corner of my eye as they turned away. Then suddenly it stopped. Presumably we dropped our torpedo. It was then that I could see what had happened to us. The fabric was peppered with three-cornered tears, as you would tear a coat on barbed wire. There was no fabric at all on the tailplane on the port side. I turned to sit down, and to one side of my seat, partly under it, there was a great big hole. The wireless set immediately in front of me wouldn't work. I turned to look forward and found on the starboard side there was oil streaming down the starboard side, obviously from the old cooler on the engine. In the upper port main plane there was a huge hole where normally the dinghy is kept. The IFF identification friend of foe worked, but as that relied on radar for some identification, I wouldn't think at sea level it would be of much use. Then we saw three motor torpedo boats, and obviously Pat Kingsville turned to go towards those, and they turned out to be E-boats. And it was then that I emptied my last bullets into 303, into them. I turned round to the observer. Kingsmill had crabbed away from this, these boats. Turned to the Observer, Max Samples, and I didn't know him as Max Samples in those days. And he put his hand down, brought it up, covered in blood from his right side. Then the distress fares that must have been lodged up in the dinghy recess suddenly started going off, streaming down the port side. And they stopped, and then shortly afterwards we hit the sea. Fortunately, we weren't too far from a mine layer which had been sent out for that purpose. And it appears that the engine where Kingsmill normally sees three cylinders, he could only see one. So there was no wonder we came to a halt. The aircraft began to sink, and I had already hit my harness buckle to release myself and get out the aircraft, but I forgot to take the helmet off, which was still plugged in, which I threw off, and by which time I turned to Max Samples, and he had floated free from the aircraft, and by this time the ML was alongside, so we weren't in the channel in February for very long, thank goodness. They put over some netting from the side of the aircraft, the boat, steel netting, and I was trying to get behind Mac to help him aboard, until some Matlow said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, bloody well, get out and let us get on, get these people in." Mac was badly injured, and he was put into the cockpit of the boat. Pat Kingsmill, I recall, went into the wheelhouse. He was injured in the foot. I was completely unscathed. And yet, there was a hole just a foot away from me, and the set didn't work where I was standing. So how I escaped, I don't know. I went down in between the two engines, and somebody gave me some dry clothes, and I stripped off my wet stuff. Then they handed me a cup of rum, and I was left there with my own thoughts. Well, we batted like mad for Ramsgate, and then we were taken by ambulance to the hospital.
What was the name of the ship that rescued you?
It was an ML. I don't know what it was. I don't recall the name. I met somebody many years later in one of the MTBs who was racing towards us, but this ML had got there first. I was left sitting in the corridor then while they dealt with the others. I must have sat there several hours. I did manage to go in and see them before I left, after a bit, after they'd got them settled up. And then somebody picked me up and took me back to the aerodrome.
Do you remember the treatment that you got at Chatham? Chatham Hospital?
No, Ramsgate Hospital it was. I didn't get any treatment whatsoever.
Didn't they put you under these bulbs to warm you up?
No. No.
Were you in a freezing condition?
I suppose I must have been, but not being wounded, I was. I was just sat in the corridor until this transport came to pick me up to take me back to the headroom.
When the attack was launched, did you see anything of the German capital ships?
No, I didn't see anything. All I saw was Fat Wolf 190s and this destroyer. And it appears we went over that destroyer twice, going in and coming out.
And the E-boats that you attacked?
Yeah. Oh.
How many survived the Saltfish attack on the Channel Dash?
Well, only two of us arrived back at Manston that day. Edgar Lee from one of the other aircrafts in the first flight, and myself. His pilot, Brian Rose, was very badly injured in the back and unfortunately was killed later in a Barracuda crash. Pat Kingswell and Max Samples I'd left in Ramsgate Hospital, and I was back at the airfield waiting for news of other people, but of course none came. All my mates from the Ark Royal had all gone. And the next day I was faced with the PO of engine fitter in packing all their kit up, which wasn't very good.
Was that a big job?
Well, there's five people's kit to be packed up. When you look at the photographs they've got around and the letters and things and all that to be pushed away. Anyway, we were finally shipped back to Leon Soland, and on the following Sunday, divisions, I was again out in front of the parade, this time not losing the hook, but being told I was some kind of a hero, together with Edgar Lee. I don't recall very much about that period, but at one point I was in having breakfast and somebody threw a copy of the Daily Mirror across to me, and it was then I found out that I had, along with Esmond and the VC, the other four officers that survived got the DSO, I had been awarded the CGM. But no one could tell me what the CGM looked like. In fact, a few days later, I was around the camp, and the first lieutenant stopped me and asked me why I hadn't got the ribbon up. I had to confess that I didn't know what it looked like. So he hauled me off to the office, and finally we found out what it looked like. And after going round all the naval tailors in Portsmouth, I finally found somebody in one of the smaller towns which had a few inches of the ribbon left. And it appears I was the first of only two to be awarded to the Fleet Air Arm during that whole period. We were there, I can't remember how long, no one said anything to me about the attack. The counselling, of course, wasn't heard of in those days, and the panacea appeared to be to send somebody on leave. If you had in these situations, which was about the worst thing that could happen to me, because when I got back to Oxford, all my mates were either in the service themselves or working all the hours God could send them in the factories, so I didn't see anyone. And at one stage I remember that I couldn't bring myself to cross the road in Oxford.
Why not?
I just felt afraid. I during that period, I had a telegram to tell me to go to London because by that time a inquiry had been set up, I think with a justice Bignall. They were taking evidence. They asked me a few questions and whatnot. I don't think I could contribute to the wider aspects of the thing. And then I got a draft from Leon Solon and the squadron to Arbroath in Scotland, joining a squadron 767, I think it was, that was doing the final training for observers. When I first got there, they didn't put me on flying. Instead, they put me in charge of the battery shop, which is keeping the batteries charged up for the aircraft. And as part of that job, it was running the OXO boat, which was, in those days, the equivalent of the T boat, because T wasn't available. You were supposed to be able to make some money at that, but I'm afraid I didn't make much money of it.
So did you ever go back into action?
No, I never went back into frontline squadron again. But that wasn't to mean that I didn't have further trauma to come. Eventually I was put back on flying again. You were either accompanying these training observers on a NAVEX over the sea or across country. And this day, again, it was in Swordfish. This day we took off from the drone in the morning. No sooner we got off than the pilot returned to, because of some engine trouble or something. So we changed aircraft and took off again. The idea evidently was to go down the coast and up the Perth Valley and back again as a cross country. We went down the coast and we went up the valley and we started to come back again. And the next thing I knew, we were in cloud. It was a day when the cloud was fairly low over the mountains, but it was all right on the coastal plain. And I don't know what had happened, but I had my suspicion is that the pilot, being late, had persuaded this training observer that we should go up over in the cloud, steer a course across the mountains and drop down onto the plain and save a bit of time. Unfortunately for them, either because the compass was not swung properly or the observer made some kind of error, we began to come down, and the next thing I knew, everything was coming up off the deck of the aircraft round my face. And we side-slipped down the side of a mountain into a valley, which was fortunately clear. He managed to pull it round, and we landed on two humps in the only flat field that was available.
Was it a crash landing?
No, it wasn't a crash landing. We actually landed properly.
What kind of plane was it?
It was Swordfish. Still in a Swordfish.
And where was this place?
It actually was in Glenshee. And
do you know the date of that?
I don't know the date of it, because by that time I'd stopped recording any flights in my logbook.
Which year would it have been?
It was It was during the time I was at Arbroath, but it would be later in 42, it would be about May 42, I would think.
So not all that long after the Channel Dash?
No. So within the first 2 years of the war, that was my third major.
Dangerous situation.
Yeah.
Do you have any VE Day memories?
Not really, because by that time I was out in Trinidad, and there was no.
Nothing special happened to you on that day.
Nothing special happened.
You said that you had that incident in Oxford after you got back from the Channel Dash about being frightened to cross the road. Mm. Were there any other problems, like nightmares or anything of that kind, that you had afterwards?
I can't recall it, but I think I must have had something like that, because I think it affected me more than I tended to admit, I think, at the time. But one just, as I only said recently, I thought everybody all had the same type of experiences as myself. But a lot did, but then many more didn't, of course.
So what did you do about crossing the road?
I eventually plucked up courage and went across. But I don't know, that's just the one thing that stays in my mind, actually.
You said there wasn't any counselling in those days. Do you think you needed any counselling? Do you think it would have done any good for you?
Well, so they say now. Evidently, the more you can talk about it at the time, the better you are. Whereas I didn't talk about it at the time. In fact, I haven't spoken about it in any depth until recent years.
Is this the longest you've talked about it on any occasion?
About the same. The recent, the recent talk I gave to the TAGS on HMS President was probably the longest I've ever talked about it. And, of course, I've been asked to write it down since then, which again means going back over it again and again, which I'm beginning to think I've had enough of it, in actual fact.
Do you find it upsetting to talk about it?
Sometimes I do, yeah.